Hi, this is David Giard, and I'm here today to talk to you about HTML5. I'm a senior manager with consultant with Sagetti, Microsoft MVP, and here's some information about how to contact me either on Twitter or at my blog. I want to start with a quote from one of my favorite authors, Douglas Adams. Douglas says, "Space is big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space." And the reason I brought this quote up is because HTML5 is big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, etc. HTML5 isn't just one thing. It's a lot of things kind of thrown together. It's an umbrella of features. It features simpler markup than HTML4 and XHTML and its predecessors. It features semantic markup, which means that the tags, in addition to telling browsers how to render, they also provide some meaning about some context about the text that they surround. HTML5 does include a lot of new tags, a lot of new attributes for existing tags, and some new rules about how attributes can be displayed. It also includes an API that you can call from JavaScript. And CSS3 is a new version of cascading style sheets, which technically isn't really a part of HTML5, but because it was released at the same time as HTML5 by the same group, the World Wide Web Consortium, it interacts very much with HTML5, and most people sort of think of them together. So I'm going to cover all these things. First thing you want to ask yourself is, can I use HTML5? Does my browser support it? Or more importantly, do the browsers that my users are using, will they support it? Because HTML5 is simply a recommendation from the World Wide Web Consortium. A lot of vendors have agreed to adapt them, but they're not going to all adapt every single feature at once. And they're not going to adapt them all in the same order. So some browsers will support a feature while other browsers will not. And it's helpful to know which ones your browsers support. There's a site here called CanIUse.com. If I go in here, it lists a lot of the features of HTML5 and CSS3. And if I click on one, like for example, offline web applications, I can see that Firefox supports it, Chrome supports it, IE10 supports it, but not IE9, which happens to be the one that I have installed on my computer right now. So I get a sense for which versions of which browsers support each feature. I've got another site here called HTML5tests.com, and they've taken all those features. They've actually assigned a score to each browser based on whether or not they've implemented these HTML5 features. This one I'm going to open up in Internet Explorer version 9, so it's going to give me a score as to what it thinks HTML5 can do in trying to support HTML5. And they get a score of 138 out of 500 points. Not a very good score, actually. It's better than IE8, but IE10, which I don't have on this computer, has a much higher score. Microsoft has gone to great lengths in the last year or so to implement more and more HTML5 features. And they've actually shown the details down here as to where they came up with that score. So it looks like they lost a lot of points on these form inputs, only 7 out of the possible 108. They scored really well on, for example, the location orientation. They got 15 out of 20 on those. So some things they did well on, some things they did not do well on. If I take that same site and it open up in, say, Chrome, then Chrome, with its frequent release schedule, has boosted itself to a much higher score, 414 out of the possible 500. It's supporting all these features almost completely. Still not 100% on the form inputs, but it's doing much better than IE9 is. So you sort of get a sense for the fact that some browsers are implementing this a lot more than other browsers. And if you want to build an application where you don't control the browsers, you have to be aware of that, and you have to provide an experience that's a good experience, no matter what the browser is. It may be less. It may be a degraded experience for some older browsers that haven't implemented everything. But you still want to make the application usable, and so we call that graceful degradation. You want to gracefully degrade the application so that it still works in browsers with a little bit less support. I mentioned these are the three pieces of HTML5: HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript API. And I've broken up this presentation more or less into three sections. I'm going to start off with HTML5. The first thing you will notice about HTML5 is the markup is a lot simpler. An example of that is in this declaration tag, where it tells it where to find information, the browser can find information about how to render this version of HTML. This is what you had to see in an HTML4 document. That's been replaced with just that. Exclamation point, doc type HTML. So this is, I can memorize this. I had no prayer of memorizing the old version. I see that as a nice thing. Similarly, if I want to specify what character set to use, this is the old way of doing it, HTML4. HTML5 that's been replaced by meta char set equals UTF-8. Everything else is implied. Linking to style sheets. The old way of doing it was link type equals text-css, rel equals style sheet, href equals, and you point to some CSS file. With HTML5, you only need this part of it. You don't need to specify type equals text-css, because generally speaking, that's the kind of style sheet you'll be using. So it's safe to set that as a default. JavaScript, the same way. I used to have to specify all this stuff to point to an external JavaScript file. Now, script source equals in the name of the file. I don't have to tell it that the type equals text/JavaScript because I don't really remember the last time that I wrote script inside of a web page, client-side script, inside of a web page that wasn't JavaScript. This is the way you do it when you link to an external JavaScript file. If you want to provide JavaScript actually inside of the HTML file, you'll place it between a script and a slash script tag, but even that's been simplified as well. We don't have to specify type equals JavaScript, just slip script and slash script, and the browser will assume everything in between is JavaScript. So that's very simple. I want to talk a little about the new tags, the new attributes. I'll pay special attention to the new form input types, because there's quite a few of those, and those are very cool. Here's a listing of all the new tags supported in HTML5. I don't really have time in this session to go through all of them, but I picked a few of them out just to give examples of. One of the things that the World Web Consortium, or the W3C, has strived for is to make this new markup more semantic. And by semantic, I mean allowing the markup itself to have some meaning beyond just the way it's going to render on the page. These are two HTML documents with very similar content to them. This is using HTML4, and this is using HTML5. You notice that I have an H1 and H2 tag up here. It's inside of a div with the class equals header div and then slash div somewhere. I go ahead and set all the closing div there. But in here, what I've done is I put them inside of a header tag instead of a div. I did have a class equals header here, but that class, that's something I made up. It could be somebody else might create the same thing. It would be a different class. The header is standard HTML5 markup, so this is valid HTML. And inside of the header, I have an H group, and inside of the H group, I have an H1 tag and an H2 tag. And this tells any kind of automated process, any kind of program, like for example, a search engine crawler, that this is the main topic of the page. I also have this nav and slash nav. Here I just used a div to hold these links to other pages in the site. But here I'm actually using a nav tag, and the nav tag is designed to say, hey, everything inside of here, that's navigation. That's how you find out where the rest of the site is located. Notice also that there is an H1 tag inside of the nav tag. Now usually that's frowned upon. The HTML4, that was not valid. You could only have one H1 tag. With HTML5, you can actually have as many H1 tags as you want, but you're limited to only one per group. So within my nav group, I can have one H1. Within my H group, I can have one H1. I've got another one down here inside of the article, and so on. Down here in the article, I've got an H1 tag and a paragraph, and I've also got an aside inside of the article to say that there's some extra information pertaining to this article. And all these things provide meaning that applications can look up and humans can look up. I could provide a style sheet for each of these and make them render exactly the same way, but the one on the right has more meaning, it's more semantic. Down here I have a footer, presumably the footer would just span across the entire bottom of the page, and so on. So it has more meaning than just div id equals footer. So I hope you can see the difference between semantic versus non-semantic. And by the way, this idea of semantic markup, it's existed for a while. Hasn't been bought into wholesale like it has with HTML5. For example, in older versions of HTML, there is an I tag and there is an EM tag. And in most browsers, those two tags render the text between them exactly the same. They make the text slanted at an angle. It makes it italics. The difference between the I and the M and EM is that EM actually conveys some meaning. EM is short for emphasis. So it's intended to emphasize that text in some way. Whereas I just says, render as italics. Don't forget about the reason why. There may be other reasons why I might have text as italics. It might be the title of a magazine article, for example. But EM says, I really want to emphasize this part of the text. So you'll see that occasionally in HTML4 and previous. But in HTML5, you'll see it all over the place. So this document here, this is the non-semantic version of it, kind of rendering a div at the top, identifying that as a header, a div at the bottom, the ID says that's a header, an article and an aside for that article. Those are all fine, but it would be tough to standardize and say, you know, is it article or is it news article, or, you know, how do I know what that article is? I replaced that with an actual header tag and a footer tag and an article tag and an aside tag, and now with this consistency, we can actually get some real information out of that using automated processes like search engines. Alright, next thing I want to talk about is attributes. There are a bunch of new attributes. Here's a couple of my favorite ones. There's something called autofocus. Notice, first of all, that there's no autofocus equals anything. It used to be that you had to have autofocus, had to have a value for this, equals autofocus equals true, or autofocus equals autofocus. Now it's not true. That seems like it's redundant, it's kind of silly. Just the presence of that autofocus attribute is enough to identify that this attribute is applied to this, and the absence of it says don't. What autofocus does is it says set the focus of my cursor to this element when the page loads. Now you could write JavaScript to do that, but why bother? Now you can do it just directly in your markup. Placeholder is another cool one. Placeholder will add this text to an input form or an input element as sort of a helpful hint as to what could be entered there. And when they start typing, that text disappears. Or when they tab to it, it disappears. Input types have been changed a lot. They added this type equals. Input is it's existed for a long time. Input type equals text will render a text box. Input type equals checkbox will render a checkbox. Input type equals submit will render a submit button, and so on. But now there's all these different types and all these different types. So you can specify which your inputs could have very specific types of information. And let me show you a couple of examples. This is a good time for a demo. Here's my form controls. And I have just a couple of controls on here. I have a text box for my first name and a text box for my last name, and I've added the autofocus property only to the first name text box, but I've added this placeholder attribute to say enter first name and enter last name. I've added the placeholder attribute to both of them so that when I view this in the browser, then IE doesn't support this one. Let me view it in a different browser. Let's say let's actually view it in Chrome. And you see that there is enter first name, enter last name. That's my placeholder. And also notice that the cursor appeared in the first name text box because of the autofocus attribute. So without writing any code, I was able to do that. Now you could do both those things either by writing some JavaScript or by using some jQuery control or something like that. But I didn't have to. It's just right there. So that's kind of nice. And as I actually type in here, that placeholder text disappears. The other thing I want to show you is the input types. Now, input types, really the leader in rendering these is the Opera browser. So if I show this off in Opera, you'll see that it's much further implemented than any of the other browsers. Almost makes you want to actually go out and use Opera, if anybody here is. I really hadn't used it until I started. Opera is not set as a default browser. No, I don't want to set it as a default browser. I just want to show this demo. Okay, so here's Opera. And what I've got in here are a bunch of different input controls. These are all input controls, but they all have a different type. I have type equals color, type equals number, type equals date, date time, type equals email, type equals URL, type equals range. And then I just have a text box here, but I've added the this list attribute to it. And I'll come back to that last, but let me just show you these other ones here. When rendered in Opera, this input type equals color actually renders a color picker. I come in here and select red. And I can say other and select some particular shade of green. And so on. For the number, and then this will return, when if I submit that form, it'll actually return the value of the hex value of that color I selected. For the number, it's a text box, but it gives me the spinner here, where I can go up, I can go down. And notice that it's the lowest I can go is 100, the highest I can go is 200, and when I click down or up, it increments by 25 each time. That's because there are a couple of other attributes on here. Min equals 100, max equals 200, step equals 25, that control that. The date provides me a little calendar control. The date time provides both a calendar control and this little time control here. Email, you won't really see any information, anything different in the email. But when we go show validation, you'll see a difference there. Same thing with the URL. The range control in, or type equals range, in Opera, it'll render it out as this slider here with little tick marks. And when I submit that, it'll show the whatever number the slider is on. And I can control this, what those tick marks do with, right here, this is the input type equals range. There is a min and a max and a step on that as well that allow me to control what those tick marks actually mean. And the last one I want to show you is bound to list. This is just a text box, input type equals text. But I've added this list equals flavors. Well, flavors points to this data list. And inside the data list, there are three options, chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry. And what that'll do is when I select it here, I can select from that list automatically. So it's a neat way of implementing a combo box in HTML5. Now, as I said, this is rendered very well in Opera. It's rendered less well in Chrome. In Chrome, I do get the color picker. I do get this spinners for the number. I do get this. Date time, I don't get anything but a text box. Email and URL, just text before. Range, I do get a slider, but I don't get the little tick marks on there. So it's really up to the browser manufacturers how they're going to implement each one of those. And the bound to list, it does work. So I get a little bit less in Chrome, but even the things that don't work, I can still type in here. It still gives me a text box. So there is, by default, this graceful degradation. And I'll get less still in IE9. These ones, really all I get is a text box for everything. Even the bound to list doesn't work. But again, I still have the opportunity to type things in. The application won't break. I'm just forcing my users just to type in the hex value of a color manually. So there is some graceful degradation going on by default. Next thing I want to talk about is validation. Now, validation, I actually have another section here on CSS3, but I thought this was important to put here in with the input forms, because the input types. Because one of the things you can add is an attribute called required. And required will say that, will tell your browser that this input requires the user to add something, that the form should not be submitted unless it's required. And we actually have styles in our CSS selector to say what we should do if an input is required, what we should do if it's valid, what we should do if it's invalid, and so on. And I have an example of that here. that shows that I've got a text box here that says input first name, and another text box that says it's input last name, and one for email, one for blog, it's type URL, the email is type email, and so on. I've got all those, and every one of these has the required attributes. So every one of these things is required. And I have applied a style sheet to the input tags that said if the input tag is required, show it with a red border. And once it contains valid text, show it with a gray border. I also have, below each input, I've got a div with a class equals validation message, which every one of these has that. It has something that says, please enter the first name. Message display if there's the date is not yet valid. Please enter the last name, and so on. They all have the same class equals validation message. And these selectors here say that if I have a valid input followed by a validation message class, then the visibility of that validation message class should be hidden. I shouldn't see this message that says please enter the first name, for example. But if I have an input that's invalid followed by a validation message class, then that visibility of that validation message class should be visible. We should show this message here. So when I view this in a browser, I'll browse it with I don't know why I don't have Chrome in here. Let me add that. So if I put Chrome, that was out of you though. How about Chrome.exe? I guess that's why I don't have it. Let's try it in Firefox. See what happens. And there it is. It's rendering with every one of these is required, and they're all empty. So every one of these is invalid. So invalid said show with a red border and make this class here visible. As soon as I start typing into the first name field, single letter, the border becomes gray because that's what valid is, and that class below it becomes visibility hidden. So that works also for here. The email doesn't quite work that way because even though it's required, it's also an input of type email. And in order to satisfy that as email, I have to have an at followed by something. It has to look like an email address. And so it won't be considered valid until then. It's only once I get the at followed by some, at least one character, that say, okay, that's good enough. That could be an email address. And then it becomes valid. Same thing with blog. I could type in here davidgr.com, but that's not good enough. I have to put the HTTP colon in front of it, or HTTPS, to make it look like a URL, because that's input type equals URL, and now it's valid. So again, you could write script to do all this, but here it is declaratively right in the markup. I'm going to talk about these next two together, video and audio. There are actually tags for rendering video and audio. Each one of those has a source attribute that I could add. Source equals and point to some for video, some video file, or some audio file. But a better way actually is to, within the video and between the video and the slash video tags, list multiple sources. And the reason that is because not every browser supports every type of video, every format of video, or every format of audio. In fact, there is no video or audio format that is supported by every single browser. So if you want to target a wide audience, you really should make your videos and your audio files available in multiple formats, at least MP4, OGV, and WebM, and that would cover almost all of the browsers. In audio, MP3, OGG, and WAV would cover almost all the browsers. If you want to have controls, the user can stop and start, you know, these kind of VCR type controls, then you need to add this controls attribute here. And the loop attribute says, as soon as the thing's done playing, play it again forever. If I add the auto attribute, then it'll start playing as soon as the page loads, which I always find very annoying, so don't do that. The the video also has something called poster. Poster, you can point it to a picture that'll display when the video is not playing. So let me show you a sample of this. Right here I have an audio tag. I've turned on the controls and I've specified multiple source files, MP3, OGG, and WAV. I've got a video. I've turned on the controls. I've added the loop, so once the video is done, it'll just start over again. And I also said preload. Preload will actually start loading the video for a smoother performance. I'm going to show this in Chrome, simply because of the files that I have available. Audio, video.htm right here. And what I have is, here's my audio tag right here. I did show the controls. I can hit play, and it will start playing. Here's my video. I can hit play, and my video will start playing here. And because I said loop, if I take it all the way to the end here, then when it stops playing, it'll actually start over again at the beginning. So that's the audio and the video tags. Next thing I want to show you is, that actually covers all the HTML5 that I'm going to cover. There are more tags, and certainly I encourage you to look them up, but we're a little pressed for time, so I just did some of the cooler ones. Next is CSS3. A lot of improvements in cascading style sheets. Before we talk about those, I want to just go through a brief primer as to what a cascading style sheet looks like and how it works. A style sheet, it can either be in an external .css file, in which case we would link to it using this syntax, although right now we don't need the type equals text CSS anymore. But we just link to it by pointing to that href equals name of the style sheet, or you could put it between a style and a slash style in within the actual web page that you're styling. And it actually works like this. You would apply a selector, and the selector will go out and find all the elements that match that selector, and to that it'll apply a series of style name and style value pairs. So you could have, I only have one here, but I can have multiple of them here. And the selector, the most common ways of creating selectors are, if I just type a word in here, it'll assume that word is a tag name. So if I typed the word span, it'll look for all of the spans on the page, and it'll apply this style to them. If I put a pound sign in front of that word, it'll look for an element on the page with an ID that matches this word, and it'll apply that style to that element. Typically, there's only one element with a given ID. And if I put a dot in front of a word, it'll assume that that word represents a class name, the name of a class. And it'll look for all the elements where class name equals this word, and it'll apply this style sheet, or this the style to it. A couple of examples for that. Let's say I have a style with that just says div. It's going to go out and find all the divs and make their background color yellow. So if I have these two divs on the page, this div selector will find both of them and make both of their background colors yellow. Pound might have, remember pound is looking for an ID. That's the selector. It's going to set the background color ID of anything whose ID equals my div. So here I've got a couple of divs on the page. One of them is ID equals my div and one of them is not. So this background color green style is going to be applied only to the one that has ID equals my div. And then this one is the dot, so that's a style. And this says dot cool div, so it's going to look on the page for any element that has class equals cool div. And apply this background color as purple to that. So if I have two divs on the page and one of them has a class equals cool div, that's the one that's going to get the purple background color. So that's CSS in a nutshell. There are other ways that you can add these, modify these selectors. That's most what you're going to do. Now with CSS 3, you've got lots more capabilities. There is a word of caution here, is that sometimes these browsers haven't implemented these styles in exactly the same way, or these CSS 3 features in exactly the same way. And sometimes what you'll have to do is, when I mention a feature, you'll have to actually put multiple styles in. One that starts with -ms-, one that starts with -moz-, one that starts with -webkit-, and one that starts with -o-, if you want to target all of the modern browsers. So ms will target IE, moz targets Firefox, webkit targets Safari and Chrome, and o targets Opera. Here's an example of that. I haven't really talked about what this transform colon rotate means, but you notice this is the name of the feature, transform. But I had to create multiple versions of the style, -ms-transfer, -moz-transfer, because I wanted this to be applied no matter what browser was running this. It's a pain in the neck, and hopefully this will get better as browsers become more standardized. That seems to be the trend. But today, this is really what you have to do. All right. Having said that, let's talk about one that doesn't require those prefixes, and that's fonts. Fonts today, or in older versions of HTML, you really were restricted to the fonts that were installed on the user's machine. If you want to do more than that, you had to do something with maybe pictures of fonts, something like that. Not so with HTML5 and CSS3. You can download fonts, you can create your own fonts, and you can specify those in your markup, in your style sheet, as long as you provide a URL to a font's WAF file. And then when you do this, you give that font family a friendly name. It's just a name that you can refer to it by. And this @fontface here, it doesn't really do anything until that font is applied. And the way the font is applied is actually the same way that it is in CSS2, is we're going to have a selector. It could be either a tag or an ID or a class or whatever. And in the font family style, we'll specify this friendly font name, which will match this font name up here. I'll show you an example of that. Right here, I've got a couple of @fontface elements inside of my style sheet. I've got one that points to the URL desirel-webfont.woff, which is one that I found out on the web. It's an open source font. I gave it the friendly name desirel. And I've got another one called that points to gooddog-webfont.woff. And I gave it a friendly font family name of Good Dog Regular. This one I also said I want to make sure that the font weight is normal and the font style is normal. And on my page, I have a couple of classes, Reckless and Crazy. And I said I want, whenever you see the class named Reckless, apply the Desirel font family to that, make it 30 points tall. Whenever you see the class named Crazy, apply the Good Dog Regular font to that and make it bigger, 60 point. And you can actually add multiple fonts here, just in case the browser doesn't support this @fontface attribute and doesn't understand it. It can fall back to something that they actually is more common than most browsers have. So down here, I can actually see a couple of divs. One of them has a class equals Reckless, it'll get this Desirel, and one of them has a class equals Crazy, and it'll get applied this Good Dog Regular 60 point. So what I'll do is in my I'll just do it right here. Fonts.htm is I spelled it wrong. Right click, view in browser. Let's try that. And there it is right here. So there's my Reckless fonts pointing showing this Desirel font, and here's my Crazy one showing the Good Dog Regular. All right. Next, we'll talk about text shadows. Text shadows are kind of nice effects to emphasize certain text on your page. And a text shadow, it really just looks like it's casting a light, is unseen light is casting a shadow on your fonts. It can be offset to the right or left. If you do that, you'll use this horizontal offset attribute. Or actually, what it is div text shadow colon and then 1, 2, 3, 4 values. So the first value will be the horizontal offset. If it's a positive number, it'll be how far to the right it's offset from the letters. If it's a negative number, it'll be how far to the left. And then vertical offset, which will tell it how far up or down this shadow should be. The blur is a number indicating how blurry it should be. The higher this number is, the more blurry the shadow will be, and the color, of course, is just the color of the text shadow. So an example of that is here. In this case, this is exactly the same page I had before. I've got a class called Reckless and a class called Crazy, and I am applying, again, those same .reckless and .crazy font family classes to each one of them. But for the Crazy, I've added this text shadow. And I said 30 points to the right, 25 points down, 15 pixels is how much blur that I want, and the color of that shadow should be gray. So if I view this in the browser, then what I'll see is, let's do it. View in browser. I'm not sure if Internet Explorer supports this one. It does not. So what I want to do, I see my problem, is right there. Right here is I have to the right and down a slightly blurry shadow of color gray. And I can customize that anyway. I put the shadow up here or there, or kind of make it a halo all around it. Alright, next CSS thing is, there's an example of it here, another Douglas Adams novel. Selectors have been enhanced far beyond just the tag, class, and ID. You can have things like positions. So if you've got a list of things that can be selected, like maybe a UL with a bunch of LI tags in it, inside of it, you can specify just the first child or just the last child, and that'll pick just the first item in that list or just the last item in that list. First of a single given type or last of a type. You could do nth child, and you provide a number to that, so I put the number 5 in there, it'll be the fifth one down. And so if you've got 10 items in the list, then the fifth one down will have that style applied to it. By the way, these lists are, they start with the number 1. I know sometimes in computer science lists start with the number 0, not so here. In this case, they start with the number 1. So you can do nth. You can do nth counting from the end. You also can in older versions of CSS, you could specify where an attribute equals some value. Here you can specify whether the attribute starts with, contains, or ends with a given value. And there's some miscellaneous things on here. Select just the root element. Select any empty elements. This is kind of cool where you select a selection. You'll apply a style to whatever the user has selected by dragging their mouse across the text. You can apply a special style just to that. And you can apply styles to elements that are enabled or disabled or checked. There are default styles that are applied by each browser. Usually they'll make disabled things look kind of grayed out, but maybe you want to do something different with that. And then we already saw the validation. I showed you required and valid and invalid. Optional is another one I didn't show you, but you can see it's just sort of the opposite of required. So let's see an example of this. And here we have the selectors by position. In this case, what I have is an unordered list with a bunch of state names in it. And I have specified, let's put this down here. I've told it li colon first child, so it's going to select all the list items, of which there are about a dozen or so. And it's going to say, okay, of those, I only want to apply to the first child. And the first child should have a background color of red. The last child in that list should have a background color of blue. And the third child should have a background color of orange. So if I show this in the browser, then I should see first one's red, last one's blue, third one is orange, just like I told it. Now, here's a cool thing that I could do. I'll comment out those styles that I had applied, and I'll replace them with this style right here. This one says li colon nth child. And rather than putting just a number in there, I'll put 2n. And 2n means every second one, all the even numbered list items, I want to apply this background color of green to. And then if I specify 2n minus 1, that says all of the odd numbered elements will have a background color of yellow. So I've created an alternating green and yellow stripes for this same list here. So you can see this would be useful for setting things off. That's probably an ugly color scheme, but maybe light green and white, so it looks like that old accounting paper. Those are kind of nice things. I actually did something like this on my blog, but I had to write some JavaScript to do it. And here's the another type of style you can add. In this case, I've just got my body has some paragraphs with a bunch of lorem ipsum text in there. And I have applied to a paragraph colon colon selection. This is a special selector that applies to when the user clicks on something and drags his mouse across it with a mouse down. You see how that gets selected in there? Well, browsers will apply a style by default. They'll highlight that text that's being selected. And I can control what that highlight looks like. In this case, I want it to be background color red and the color is blue. But before I actually show this, I'll comment it out. Just to refresh your memory as to what it looks like by default. By default, when I select text, it turns to blue background with white text. That's the default style that's applied to selected text. But what I want to do is make it blue text on a red background. So if I refresh this page now, when I select it, that selection is different. So I can make my selections match the color scheme of my site. It's a nice feature. Resizing. With resizing, you select whatever the elements you want to make resizable, and you add this resize style, and you can give it a value of both, or horizontal, or vertical, or none. Both means you can resize it both in the horizontal and the vertical directions, but you can restrict that to one or the other. Overflow colon auto is required. I don't know why it's required, it just is. And these last two you don't have to add, but if you want to restrict how far they can make it, how far they can widen it, how far they can make it tall, you could do so by adding max width and max height. So I have an example of this as well. This is for resize right there. And in here, I have I'm playing a cruel joke here. I've got a complaint entry form. And what can happen is I've got a text area here. And I've told it that the text area only has 10 columns and 2 rows. It's a pretty small text area because I don't want to add a lot of complaints. But I've let them go by making that ID equals complaints. That'll match this text area. ID equals complaints right here. I said, let's make it resizable, both vertically and horizontally. And so what'll happen is when I view this in the browser, then, yeah, that's a tiny text box. It's hard to type anything in here. But I did allow them to actually make it bigger, both horizontally and vertically. I can't make it any wider than 600 pixels, though. That's the limit I set on it. Rounded corners. Rounded corners, of course, are the cornerstone of Web 2.0 applications and websites. Everybody went crazy for rounded corners a few years ago, and they're kind of hard to do in CSS 2. You essentially had to apply pictures on top of pictures and put pictures in for each one of these corners. Well, they're much, much simpler in CSS 3. All you have to do is apply a border radius and set equal to some value. The bigger this value, the more round this corner will, these corners will be. The smaller that value, the more pointy they'll be. And I can apply a border radius colon some value to all of the corners, just like this. Or I can just, if I only want certain corners to be affected, I can say border top left radius, border bottom left radius, border top right radius, and border bottom right radius. But in this case here, just these two would create an element that looks kind of like this. And an example of that is here I've got input type equals text. That's a text box. There's a text area. This is actually the same page I had before. A text box followed by a text area followed by input type equals submit. So I've got two input elements and a text area element. And what I've said is for the input element, I want it to be top left radius and top right radius. So only the two on the top will be rounded. The bottom one won't. But for the text area, I want everything to be have rounded corners. So what that'll do, if I view in browser, now I'll see there's my inputs. They're only rounded this way, this kind of cool looking thing here, whereas this text area is actually rounded on all four corners. So it gives you some flexibility about how you want to make this thing. Next up, transforms. There's three different types of transforms: rotate, skew, and scale. Let's talk about these ones each in turn. Rotate is exactly what it sounds like. You take an object and you'll rotate it along some point, either counterclockwise or clockwise. The way it's done is you'll have a selector here, and you'll specify transform colon rotate. And you add a parameter of the number of degrees to rotate. If it's a negative number, it'll rotate it counterclockwise. Positive numbers will rotate it clockwise. This is one of those things that not everybody has implemented just the feature name itself. So if you want to target all browsers, you have to say -ms-transfer -moz-transfer -webkit-transform -o-transform for that. Skew is also a transform. It's transform colon either skew x, skew y, or just skew. Skew x and skew y do what you expect to do. They will tilt your shape along the x-axis. They'll tilt it horizontally so that these horizontal bars stay the same and the vertical ones get tilted to the left if it's a negative number, to the right if it's a positive number. Skew y will tilt, they'll keep the vertical axes the same and they'll make the horizontal axes crooked. And skew takes two parameters, x and y, and then you can skew both of them, you tilt them both. The last one I want to show, these ones also, because the transform, you have to implement all these, MS transform, MLZ transform, WebKit transform, and O-dash transform. So each one of these, it becomes a pain in the neck, but if you want to target other browsers, you have to do it. And then scale is changing the size of an object, changing it by a given factor. A factor of 1 means don't change the size at all. Numbers greater than 1 will increase it in size. Less than 1 will decrease it in size. So greater than 1 increases, less than 1 decreases. We do have this scale x, which will increase it or decrease it only in the horizontal direction, and scale y, which will increase or decrease it only in the vertical direction. These, again, transform has to have all these if we want to target all those browsers. So let's see an example of all three of these. What did I start with? I started with the rotate. So rotate, I've got a div here with ID equals title, and it has the words words don't panic written in large friendly letters. And ID equal title is my selector here, and in it I specify this transform. Actually, I've specified that several times for all browsers. And I said I want to rotate this negative 15 degrees. So what that's going to do is it'll rotate that div 15 degrees counterclockwise. Very simple. The skew in this case, I have three divs. One of those has an ID of x, one has an ID of y, and one has an ID of xy. And I have specified for ID equals X, I want to skew X. I want to just skew it in along the X-axis, so it'll make it tilt, sort of tilt to the right a little bit. And for the ID equals Y, I want to skew that along the Y-axis. And for the ID equals XY, I want to skew it along both the X and the Y-axis. And I've added all these prefixes to each of them so that it'll work in many different browsers. I've also got a div with an ID equals just like rotate, and I created that just to prove a point, which is that here's the selector ID is just like rotate, that when I skew -150 X and 150 for Y, that's exactly the same thing as rotating at 150 degrees. So let's take a look at that in the browser. And here is my skew X. This is my skew Y. This is my skew X and Y, where this thing is tilted up counterclockwise and then scrunched to the right, so it's kind of very narrow. And this is skewing with one of the values is positive, the X value is positive, and the Y value is negative. Or maybe it's the other way around. I think it is the other way around. And this is identical to actually rotating that object. And the final transform one I have is for the scale, where I'm actually going to change the size. And in this case, I've got a list here, an unordered list, a bunch of li elements in the middle of it. I don't need to have the closing li tag, by the way. That's not required by HTML5. And I have on the hover, li colon hover, that'll select a list item, but only when the user is hovering over it. Then I want to transform using scale x. In other words, I only want to change the size along the horizontal axis, and I want to double that size. Transform it by a factor of 2. And I've done it for all these browsers. So that'll happen when I hover over one of those list items here. Let's take a look at this in the browser. And here we go. Hovering over it doubles the size horizontally of each element, but keeps the Y the same. Very cool. Next thing I want to show is animations. Animations are really a two-part thing, just sort of like fonts were. We have to declare what the animation is, or declare a keyframe. And we define the keyframe, we give it a name, and then we say from some style, or it might be a set of styles here, to some style. And you can do it this way, or else you can do it 0% and 100%. These are actually identical. The reason you might want to use percentages instead is you might want to add more percentage in between 0 and 100% to have control over how it gets from the first point to the last point. So for example, keyframes black, white, gray would go from 0%, this is all black, to 20, at the 25% of the time, it'll be at this shade of gray, and at 50% of the time, it'll be that shade of gray, 70% of that shade of gray, until finally it's all white. So these at keyframes by themselves don't do anything until we actually use them in a style selection. So we specify a selection, like a tag or an ID or a class name, whatever, and we apply animation colon, and that name right there, that black, gray, white, refers to this keyframe's name up here. We give it that, and that says it's going to go through this whole thing, and it's going to take a finite amount of time to go through it. How much time? Well, that's the next attribute here, is 8 seconds. Animation colon black, gray, white says go through this progression here, but and do it in exactly 8 seconds. We also have a couple other things we can add to the end of this, like we could add infinite, which says I want to go through this, and when I'm done, I'm going to go through it again. Go from black to gray to white, and then to black to gray to white, and then black to gray to white over and over again. If I say alternate, it'll go in black to gray to white, and then it'll go backwards. White to gray to black to gray to white, but it'll do it again forever. And once again, this is I'll have to add these prefixes in front of it, at least for now. So let me show you an example of this here. Q keyframes. What I have, I've got actually a class called box here that I'm applying to a div. Class equals box. So let's show up as a square on here. It just says some text, mostly harmless, on here. And that'll appear in a box that's has a black background and white text. And then I've declared these keyframes here. They're all actually all identical. I just put prefix in front of some of them. And it says I want to go from black to dark gray, to lighter gray, to light gray, to white. And that's what each one of these does. So just declaring them, as I said, doesn't do anything. I actually have to apply it somewhere. And right here, I'm applying it to ID equals rectangle, which is that same div, ID equals rectangle. I'm going to apply an animation, and I'm specifying that it's black, gray, white, which is the friendly name that I gave. I gave that same friendly name to all of them, the same keyframe to every single one of these. And I want it to last for 5 seconds, and I want it to go forever, and I want it to go backwards and forwards. So what's going to happen here is that it starts out black, and I got another one that doesn't quite work in IE, so I'll do it in Chrome. Starts with white text on a black background and ends up as black text on a white background, and shades goes through 3 different shades of gray. I should make it 50 shades of gray. That'd be cooler. Be sexier. But actually, you can see in the middle there, there's actually the text and the background have the same shade of gray, and so the text actually becomes invisible. And because it's alternate infinite, it keeps going back and forth. Next thing is transitions. Transition will actually take an existing style and tell it to take its time. Don't go to that style right away, just take your time. How much time? Well, transition colon whatever. In this case, when the background changes, I want it to take 2 seconds to change. So for example, if I have a selector that with a hover qualifier after it, I'm telling it here that whenever this item is selected and the user hovers over with their mouse, it should change the background color to green and then the text color to white. The text color, by default, these two will change instantly. As soon as I hover over it, they should change. But because I've applied a transition to it, then the background is going to take 2 seconds to change. The foreground color will still take go instantly, but the background color will take 2 seconds to change. I could specify all instead of background, and all says, you know what, every single one of these things, it should transition in 2 seconds. So I have an example of that here. We've already seen this page here. It's an unordered list with a bunch of hitchhikers in it. And in my selector for ID or class name equals hitchhikers, I have added the transition feature. And I've said any transition that happens here, I want all of them to take 2 seconds, no matter what they are. Don't be instant, take 2 seconds. And down here, there's an opportunity for a transition because when you hover over that hitchhikers class, it's going to change from what was the original. Originally, it's a green background with white text, and it's going to change to a white background with green text. But it won't happen instantly. Instead, it'll happen over a period of 2 seconds. And I had to add that for all these browsers here. So if I view in browser, now when I hover over it, it changes instantly. I think this is one that doesn't work in IE, so I'll have to go into some other browser and add it. And now when I hover over it, it doesn't change instantly. It takes 2 seconds before it goes from white on green to green on white. It's kind of a nice effect. It's really interesting when we start moving over it. I hover over it for less than 2 seconds. Um, So in here, I'm just emphasizing that you have to add all these other prefixes to it as well. It's one of those things. All right, that covers CSS. That gives you a good overview of some of the things that are available to you declaratively using CSS3. Next, I want to talk about some of the new APIs that you can call through JavaScript. First thing you want to do is, I talked about this earlier, we want to have graceful degradation. For a lot of this stuff, it happens automatically. That if it can't render an input type equals datetime, it'll show a text box. So these you could type a datetime in. That's okay. But some of these things you're going to want to write a script for, you don't want to write a lot of script to manipulate, say, the canvas tag if your browser doesn't support the canvas tag. So you really should, in your script, test to see whether that browser supports it before you start executing a bunch of script against it. And the easiest way to do that is with a library called Modernizer. You can download this from modernizer.com, and then it'll be a JS file that you download called modernizer-some version number. I got this about a week ago, so this is probably the current version number, but it'll change. And we'll add a script source equals that JavaScript file and the location of it. So you'll add this somewhere on your website and point to it. And then what this modernizer script does is it provides an object called the modernizer object. It'll already be available, it'll be instantiated, and it'll have a bunch of properties. And those properties will all return Booleans. They will return true if that property is supported in this browser, and they'll return false if it's not. So modernizer.canvas will return true in Internet Explorer 9, but it'll return false in IE 7. And so you could bracket your code saying, you know, if modernizer.canvas, then write all this canvas code. Else, either don't do that feature or provide some other way. Maybe you'd have a Flash app that did the same thing, or a Silverlight app to provide the same functionality. So let me show you an example of this here. And in this case, all I'm doing is I've downloaded Modernizer. I put it in a scripts folder here, so I have to give the actual relative path of it. And I'm just writing out document.write. The Canvas feature is something supported in this browser. And that something is, if not modernizer.canvas, then we write out not. So it'll either say the Canvas feature is supported in this browser, or the Canvas feature is not supported in this browser, depending upon the value of this Boolean property of the modernizer object. Modernizer object is provided by this modernizer JavaScript. And I did this for a bunch of properties. I did the same thing for local storage, modernizer.localStorage, and for modernizer.audio, modernizer.geolocation, modernizer.css_gradients, and so on. And so if I view this in the browser, for this particular example, all it does is just writes out the canvas feature is supported in this browser, but the CSS gradients feature is not supported in this browser. So I can write some defensive code saying I'm not going to try to implement the CSS gradients feature if modernizer.css_gradients is false. Next thing I want to talk about is Canvas. Canvas is a big topic. Canvas is designed to give you absolute pixel-by-pixel control over the elements on your page, so you can create art, you can create games, you can create lots of interactive things. I'm just going to show you the basics of it here. Essentially, what you need to do is you'll provide a Canvas element on your page, give it an ID so you can select it, and in your script, you will select that canvas, in this case document.getElementById, and let's pass in my canvas, that's the ID here. That gets this object that represents that canvas. And what you need to do is you need to get a context object. So canvas.getContext, pass in 2D. I think that's all you get passed in today. Hopefully in the future they'll also have 3D as well. That would be very nice. But right now, this will return a context object, and it's that context object that you'll actually use to manipulate the items on the canvas, like to draw things on the canvas and to manipulate them. And it'll do things like begin path, which will start a drawing, move to, which will tell it exactly where to start the drawing. You can do a line to or an arc to draw lines or curved lines, respectively. You can call context.fill to complete a shape, to fill in a shape, or context.fillRect will pass in the corners of the rectangle, and it'll actually draw a rectangle in that shape, and so on. So there's a lot of options here for drawing things, and I'll show you a simple example of that here. In this case, I do have a canvas tag, ID equals my canvas, and I've applied a style to it. The style is just puts a gray border around the outside of it. You really don't need that, but just for this demo, I wanted you to see the borders of the canvas. And then my JavaScript, I first get a reference to that canvas element, get element ID my canvas, and then I call canvas.getContext to get my context object. And then I can start drawing with that context object. And I have three methods here: draw triangle, draw rectangle, and draw circle. Here's the draw triangle. I can call canvas.getContext to make sure that I actually have that context object that supports the context. That's sort of another defensive programming mechanism. And then I'll call begin path to make sure it knows that I'm about to start drawing. Context.moveTo tells it where, at what position I'm going to start drawing something. And then line2 will draw a line from 25, 25 to 75, 100. The other line2 will draw a line from 75, 100, these are the xy coordinates, to 25, 100. And context.fill will actually fill it in. This is two lines. It'll fill in that third line back to 25, 25. Draw rectangle. I can do that just one line of code. Context.fillRect and give it these four values. Actually, I think this is the x, y, and the width and the height. I think that's what those four are. And I could call a context.fillStyle, so the next time I draw something, it'll be, in this case, it'll be red. RGB value is 500, 0, 0. That says that my rectangle is going to be red. Oh, didn't want to do that. And draw circle. Tell it to begin path, to say I'm going to start a new drawing here, and I call context.arc. It tells it to draw a curve line, and on here, I haven't memorized what all these are, but there's something like, I think this is the starting point of the arc that I'm drawing. This is, I think, the diameter of it. I forgot what that is. It's probably the thickness of the border, and this is the how far to draw the arc. In this case, I want it to be 2 pi, so it'll go all the way around the circumference of a circle. I give it a fill style equals blue, so it'll be filled in with blue, and then when I call context.fill, that's when it actually displays on the screen. So what I can do, if I view in browser, you will see the results of draw triangle, draw rectangle, and draw circle. And there's that border around the canvas I talked about. That just scratches the surface here. There are all kinds of things you can do to animate those and make them more interactive. But that's we don't have nearly much time to cover that. Just got a couple more things to talk about. One is data attributes, or data dash attributes. These are a new, this is kind of a different thing in HTML. Now, previously, the W3C would define all of the elements and all the attributes that were allowed. And now they're defining anything, any attribute that starts with data dash, no matter what the rest of this is, that's valid. That's valid markup. And so this data dash is designed so that you can actually apply some invisible data to the elements on your page. So for example, if I have a div and I add an attribute data dash first name equals David, then no matter what's rendered out here, I have hidden this bit of data, this word David, in this div tag. I've assigned it a name value pair. First name, the name is first name and the value is David. And I can access that through script like this. Get element by ID F name, that's this right here. So I'll get the div, and then div.dataset first name will return whatever data.first name value is. I can get that and I can set it. Now, this isn't entirely supported by all the browsers yet. The good news is, though, that jQuery has implemented a solution which will use the data dash attributes if they're use this API if it's available, and it'll figure it out if it's not available. And let me show you an example of that. In this case, I have a div up here. The only thing that's visible in this div is the word car. But I've got some data behind here via these data dash attributes. Data dash brand equals BMW. Data dash year equals 2012. And what I can do is I can pull that information out of this div and apply it down here in these span tags, where right now, by default, just say the brand is unknown and the year is unknown. But I can get a reference to this my car div right here. And in there, I'll get the dot data. This is a jQuery thing. And that'll return all of the values of these data dash attributes. There's two of them. There's the brand and the year. And then once I have that, I can get the data of brand and the data of year. And store those to local variables. And then I can take these spans down here. ID equals brand span, ID equals year span, and I can change brand span and year span to actually reflect the brand and the year that I got out of these data dash attributes. So this script right here will change this span to BMW and that span to 2012. Knockout.js is a scripting library that uses data dash attributes extensively in order to do data binding dynamically. So it makes AJAX calls out to the server, and automatically all of the data that's bound to them get updated via these data dash attributes. The last thing I want to cover is web storage, the web storage API. Web storage API is for storing data on the local client, on the client. Typically, when you store data, it's on the server. You have more control over it. It's certainly more secure. But sometimes we store data on the client. We do that with cookies, but cookies are limited. They only have they have a small amount of storage, whereas web storage can be anywhere from 2 to 10 megabytes, depending upon which browser you're using and how you've configured it. The World Wide Web Consortium recommends 5 megabytes, but in their recommendation, they confess that that might change if they get feedback from the community at large. So figure they're going to have somewhere around 5 megabytes. That's typical. Now, there's two types of web storage. There's local storage and there's session storage. And the difference between the two is that local storage is keeps its data even after the browser is closed. Session storage is only available while the browser is open. So as long as you're in the same session, even if you go away from the page and come back, you'll keep that session storage. That's true of local storage, but local storage will persist even after you close the browser and come back to it the next day. So let me show you that API through an example. And right now what I've got is a couple of divs here, and they have a couple of hits. The page hits local is one span, and the other span has an ID of page hits session. So I want to update these values in the span. They start at 0. And the way I do that is when the page loads, I get a reference to window.localStorage, stored in LStorage here, and I'm looking for a property called pageLoadCount. That's just some value that I'm storing in here. PageLoadCount counts the number of times I've accessed that page. If I don't have it, I'll set it to 0. If I do have it, then I'll just I'll start with whatever it was in storage, in local storage. And once I have that, then I'll increment it by 1. That's what this line here does. It'll increments, turns it into an integer, and adds 1 to it. And then I set the value of this span down here, pages local, to whatever it is now. So the first time it'll be 1, second time it'll be increment, it'll be 2, and third time will be 3, and so on. It'll change every time I refresh the page. This next bit of code right here is identical to what I just showed you, except it uses session storage instead of local storage. And when it's done incrementing session storage, then it's going to update this other span down here. So what I'll see when I view in browser is, I've run this before, so local storage says that it's been accessed 14 times, but session storage says it's been accessed only one time. That makes sense because I just started the session. If I refresh the page, they both increment. So they keep getting bigger, 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 until finally they're 26 and 13. But if I close the browser and then I reopen it, then the session storage gets reset to 1, whereas local storage keeps on counting. So this is a nice way of storing extra information on the client for the convenience of the client. There's some issues with it. It's not as secure. It's possible for, if you were in a co-hosting environment, it's possible for other applications to get to this data. So you really should only do it if you're in a dedicated hosting environment. It does have the advantage that this data doesn't get sent back and forth along with each request like a cookie does. So you can store more, and it's very efficient. It also has a disadvantage that people could hack this data and maybe change some values and change the way that your application actually works. So you want to make sure you don't rely on that for security things. It's more of a convenience to the user. And that's all I have for the APIs. I just want to point out that I'll be speaking Thursday in Louisville and in August in Wisconsin, and I'll be back in Michigan in November and probably have a few more lined up before then. I want to thank Telerik for making it possible for me to travel to all those conferences and user groups. My name is David Giard. You can get to me on Twitter at David Giard, and view my blog at davidgiard.com or view my TV show technologyandfriends.com. Here's a picture from 20 years ago of me when I actually met Douglas Adams, and so I thought I'd finish with that. And thank you very much.